Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our live broadcast. Tonight we're looking at Anguttara Nikaya Book of Threes, Sutta 21. No, not 21. Sutta 19 and 20. Apapanika. Apapanika. Apana. An apana is a shop. Pa. Papa. Someone who. Papa nika. Someone who keeps a shop. A shopkeeper. I think this is. This one's interesting. Similes are always nice. They give us a frame of reference. Something that we're familiar with, how meditators should behave. Well, think of a meditator like a shopkeeper. Shopkeeper has to concern themselves with profit and loss. They have to concern themselves with their goods and their customers. Shopkeepers have to work. That's really the key here. So the first sutta is about how shopkeepers have to work. In Book of Threes, we have three ways in which a shopkeeper doesn't succeed, doesn't prosper. Three ways in which a shopkeeper is incapable of acquiring yet wealth not yet acquired or increasing wealth already acquired. That's quite a simple formula. There's nothing complicated here. They don't work in the morning. They don't work in the afternoon, in the middle of the day, and they don't work in the evening. And they don't work at all. They don't apply themselves. Same with a bhikkhu, a meditator who, possessing three faculties, is incapable of achieving a wholesome state, just like a shopkeeper. Shopkeepers have to work. To maintain their shop, they have to be vigilant. If you're not careful, the shoplifters will come in, take away your goods. If you're not careful, people will cheat you. If you're not careful, your goods will be ruined by mice and disease and moths, and your shop will be ruined by rain and so on. If you're not careful with your taxes, the king will take away, or the government will take it away. Take away your shop. Same with a monk. A monk has to be vigilant. If a monk doesn't practice in the morning or the evening, or the day or the evening, then they'll lose everything they have. They lose all their spiritual gains and all the benefit of living the holy life. If a meditator doesn't apply themselves in the morning, then in the morning they lose their concentration, they lose their focus, they lose their clarity of mind. They don't, during the day, if they slack off, they lose what they gained in the morning. If they don't in the evening, then they lose what they gained in the day. When we sleep at night, we lose something. Meditation is something that has to become very much a part of your life. The more vigilant you are, the more benefit, the more you prosper in the spiritual path. We have shoplifters coming to take away our spiritual gains in the form of defilements. Anger will take away your spiritual gain, greed, delusion, worry, restlessness. Five hindrances will take away your spiritual gain. When your mind is distracted by worldly things, it's like a leaky roof raining down on your goods. and they become ruined if we don't spend our morning, our day, and our night in mindful practice. You might think, well, I'm not a bad person. I can just live my life in an ordinary way. I won't do anything. I won't purposefully get angry or greedy. I just live my ordinary life. I don't really need to meditate. This is like leaving your, the Buddha said, like leaving your roof. Leaks in your roof, the rain will come in. Uti samati ricchati. Evang abhavitam cittam. An uncultivated mind is like a poorly thatched roof. I mean, so this is a good one, I think, for people living their lives to remember that. Remember two things. First of all, that, and in fact, it's interesting because it seems to imply that if you practice in the evening, well, you're at least you're good in that sense. You know, if you don't practice mindfulness or good things in the morning and during the day, but then in the evening you do some meditation, or in the evening you go and listen to a Dhamma talk or that kind of thing, then you get gain from that. But what's really bad is if you never do anything. You spend your days never doing anything beneficial, never doing anything to your gain, for your spiritual gain, spiritual development. But the other thing is that to point out that any time that we're not engaged in mindful exercise of keeping our minds clear, it's a time when the mind can become caught up in defilement, distraction and defilement, caught up in unwholesomeness, and lose our spiritual gain. Or not succeed. You know, we won't prosper spiritually, just as a shopkeeper won't prosper if they don't put out effort. So we should think of spirituality as kind of like work. It's a job you have to do. It's a duty. It's a chore, in a sense. It's not something that should be seen as simple or easy or even comfortable. It should challenge you. And it's something you have to maintain, you have to work at. Happiness is something that you have to work for. Happiness doesn't just fall in your lap. It's not just something you can rely upon to always be there. Happiness requires perfection, requires goodness, requires strength, power, purity, all things that you have to work for. That's the first one, quite a simple sutta. The second one's a little more interesting. So, on the theme of a shopkeeper, a shopkeeper needs three factors, has to possess three factors, three things, in order to attain vast and abundant wealth. If someone has these three things, if a shopkeeper maintains these three things, they will soon attain vast and abundant wealth. What three? A shopkeeper has keen eyes, is responsible, and has benefactors. And how does a shopkeeper have keen eyes? Keen eyes, is responsible, and has benefactors. These three things. Keen eyes means the shopkeeper has to know about an item, has to understand their goods. They have to understand the relationship between goods and money. If I sell the goods at this price, I'll get this much gain. They have to be good with money. They have to know how much capital is required. If I sell it at this price, then I'm going to need this much capital. I'm going to make this much profit, and I need this much profit to achieve my goals, and so on. And, you know, economics. the laws, they have to know the laws of economics, the economic formulas. Sound like something a meditator has to concern themselves about, or what does this have to do with meditation? No? Well, how is a shopkeeper responsible? Moving along. A shopkeeper is being responsible means they are skilled in buying and selling. They are skilled and also they are engaged in it, meaning they don't just slack off and let the goods sell themselves. They engage with customers and they work at promoting, right? And they do all the activities that a successful and skilled shopkeeper undertakes. They work to sell their goods. And a shopkeeper finally should have benefactors. Should have people, investors, you might say, I suppose. Yes, investors. They should have investors who give capital, because how else are you going to buy? How else are you going to buy the goods? How else are you going to set up your shop and keep your shop going? So you don't work with only the money that you bring in, you work also on loans and capital, you know, people who support you and give you wealth. Because from your own modest upbringing or beginnings, you can never become rich, you can never become a successful shopkeeper. So three things that anyone looking to set up shop should think about. One, you should be smart about economics. Two, you should be hardworking. And three, you should have investors. Possessing these three factors, a shopkeeper soon attains vast and abundant wealth. So what the heck does that have to do with us? It's quite clever, actually, because there are three neat parallels with meditators. A meditator should have keen eyes, be responsible, and have benefactors or investors. So how does a meditator have keen eyes? Well, they know the formulas. Not economic formulas, but economic in a sense, in a spiritual sense. They understand that if I do this, this comes from it. If I do that, that comes from it. The Four Noble Truths, they understand this is suffering and this is the cause of suffering. These things that I cling to, these are suffering. Why are they suffering? Because I'm clinging to them. Because they can't, and because they can't support that clinging. They can't support my addictions. My attachment to these things is a cause for suffering. Why? Because they're impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. Seeing this about your experience. Seeing that the body is changing all the time and you can't rely upon it. Any expectations you have in the body are going to be disappointed. The feelings, memories, thoughts, consciousness are all undependable. You can't depend upon them. Understanding the laws of cause and effect. This comes from meditation. This is something you can learn about, but it's much more something that you have to get through experience, just like a shopkeeper. You work as a shopkeeper's apprentice, so you work as a meditator, practicing to be a practitioner, to be a meditator. And you gain this sort of experience through the practice. So how is a meditator responsible, like a shopkeeper keeps an eye on their goods and works to sell them, while a meditator works to cultivate insight? It's hard work meditating. Try walking and sitting for hours a day. It's something you have to be patient with and methodical. Something you have to strive towards. You have to believe in it. It has to be seen as worth doing. If a shopkeeper isn't intent upon riches and isn't intent upon greatness, they'll never prosper, they'll never succeed. But if a meditator is not intent upon spiritual development, they also will not succeed. And the third one, so what does a meditator need investors for? You might think this refers to meditators needing food or something, but no, clever. The investors for a meditator are teachers, people who will answer their questions, people who will explain the teachings to them. These are people who invest their teachings in the meditator. They think the meditator is worth teaching. This is someone who is worth passing along the treasure, worth investing their time and energy in, because they fully expect to get a return, that this person will become better, will become in and of themselves a great and wonderful person with profound insight. Maybe they don't expect such a return, but they do expect a return in that sense, because they wouldn't teach people who weren't able to benefit from it. But they don't expect anything for themselves, but they expect a return in terms of progress for the meditator. The meditator will gain spiritually, will benefit from it. If they look at the meditator and they think, oh, this person is incompetent, then they wouldn't invest their time and energy teaching them. So these three, for a monk, we should think of ourselves as a shopkeeper. Our shop is the meditation practice. And we set up shop and we undertake to gain from our goods. Walking and sitting is like a great work that you do that gives great benefit and great income, prosperity, spiritual prosperity. But you have to have a keen eye. It means you need wisdom. That has to come from real practice. You can't just do walking and sitting like a buffalo. You have to be clever and be attentive. And then you have to work like a shopkeeper works, long hours. And then you have to rely upon your teachers. Don't expect to gain, and that you don't think that you know everything and that you don't ever need any help. Don't be too proud to accept the advice of others. Submit yourself to a teacher. It's very important. So that's our Dhamma for this evening about a shopkeeper. Before questions, we have, I think, a couple of announcements, or one announcement anyway. We're going to have a meeting Sunday. Right, Robin?
Yes, we have a volunteer group that helps support the monastery, and most of us live very far from the monastery. We do things online, but we always need new people. Sometimes our very dedicated volunteers, life gets busy, and they kind of need a break from their duties, so we could really use, you know, anyone who's interested to show up at our meeting. We meet on Google Hangouts on Sunday at 1 o'clock, and we're hoping to meet this Sunday. I realize that's kind of close, but for anyone who is available, I'll put a link into the meditator shout box, so people can just jump into the, click the link and jump into the hangout.
You'll put the link on Sunday, no? Sunday at 1?
We'll have a
link.
Sunday, yes, on Sunday.
So come back on Sunday and you'll see
Sunday
the link.
At 1 o'clock. Yeah, it's nice. It's a nice group, and, you know, it's not a huge commitment. If you just want to show up and just see what kind of projects need working on, you're very welcome to. You're not gonna walk away feeling overwhelmed. Whatever, you know, if a person is interested in whatever time or talents they're willing to share, very happy to have those time of talents.
Okay. Questions?
Yeah.
kama chanda, ekagata. I don't know. I mean, I know that each jhana factor is supposed to attack one of the hindrances, but really they all, you know, they all work together. When your mind is fixed and focused on a single object, your mind is perfectly pure during that time. So there's no room for kama chanda, vayapada. There's no room for the hindrances. It's quite simple. The hindrances come from diversifying, from reacting to the experience. If you keep your experience focused on a single object, then there's no room for the reactions to come. I mean, that's the idea of the jhanas. Well, there's two parts to ego. There's belief in self and... Well, there's three parts, I guess. There's the belief that there is a self. There is conceit about oneself. And then there is attachment to possessions. So those three are the three aspects of what one might call ego. They're based on three defilements. Ditti, which is views. Mana, which is conceit, and tanha, which is craving. So those three working together are they're the, you know, one way of understanding the problem or the defilements. Ditti, mana, tanha. Yes, that's, I think, something, sounds like something quite different. Hopefully I won't get too scolded for this question. If you have that feeling, it's a feeling, and it should be noted as thus, as such. And this is the problem with spiritual practitioners, that they interpret things. So you have a feeling and that a perception, and those should be seen as feelings and perceptions. The feelings arise and cease, the perceptions arise and cease. Just because you perceive something to be X doesn't mean it's X. This is what happens with other religions. They perceive things to be God, they perceive things to be meaningful. They find meaning in things that are not meaningful. This is why the Buddha said, don't pay attention to the particulars, because that's infinite. What it might be is infinite, but what it actually is a feeling or a perception. And if you look at that perception, you'll start to see, oh, actually consciousness is something that arises and ceases. The perception arises and ceases. I don't scold people for questions, do I?
All the time, Bhante.
All right, I'll be more careful.
I had a nickel for every time you said, well, that's not a very good question.
No. That feeling that you're about to do something, that's called intending. I mean, I wouldn't become too technical or philosophical about it. You can call it what you like, but it's kind of like an intention. There's an intention to stand, an intention to walk. And if that feeling comes up, then you just say intending, intending. The whole idea of self is just too much trouble. It's more trouble than it's worth. I wouldn't worry about, is there a self, isn't there a self? The Buddha didn't, and he didn't frame it that way, because it wasn't useful to do so. It's useful to look at things as non-self. So that intention that you have is not self. It arises and ceases. which is sort of sounds like that's what you're seeing. And if you get confused, then you should say confused, confused. That's okay too. But no, that's maybe being a little bit facetious, because it's a good question. I say questions are good as well.
That's true. That is true. Welcome back to Dar. One of our meditators has been away for a long time. She's back from a long retreat. Welcome back.
She's also active on Second Life, one of the teachers
yes.
there. What sort of forcing did I say is good? Must have been a slip, because I don't normally say that forcing is good. The other thing I can think of is pushing yourself to practice. I mean, you kind of sometimes have to push yourself. In a conventional sense, forcing can be good, but in an ultimate sense, when you actually get down to, like, you're doing the meditation, and you've kind of maybe, this is all I can think of, it's not, I wouldn't usually use the word forcing, but if you forced yourself to meditate, you say, okay, I don't want to meditate, but I'm going to do it anyway. But then when you actually meditate, you can't force yourself. You're just trying to observe. And it's very important that you don't engage in forcing anything. And if you see that you're forcing something, that you note that as well, rather than cling to it as I'm forcing, me forcing.
And this is the same person. Also, I still fail to understand what it means to take breaks during intensive practice, because when I take those mindful breaks from formal meditation during an intensive practice, it's always at least as difficult as it is to just continue formal meditation. Do you mean that sometimes one should relax a little during the break?
Informal meditation is going to be less intensive. It's not. It shouldn't be as difficult. Although I get what you're saying. It's actually sometimes just as easy to continue meditating. Well, in that case, then continue doing it. But, you know, being able to stretch your limbs and go outside and be a little bit less intensive about your meditation. If you, you know, you should still be mindful walking around, but it's less repetitive. There's in a conventional sense, it's a relaxing thing for the meditator, but in an ultimate, in the end, you know, you're right. The break will be just as much trouble. It's also good for your body to take a break, to not have to sit still for so long. So if you get up and I don't know, stretch or something. But I always find that on an intensive practice, it's like, well, what does a break mean, really? It gives you a chance to step back. I guess probably the best thing that it does is that it gives you a chance to step back and look at your practice. You know, what am I doing wrong? Why am I so stressed out? If it's difficult, taking a break allows you to step back and readjust to make it more more efficient.
My breathing during meditation has a few seconds of stopping after exhaling, after falling. Do I notice somehow, or just the inhale and exhale, rising, falling? If I insist on inhaling quickly, then it's controlling, right?
Yeah, you don't have to say anything during that. Just rising and falling is fine. After some time, we'll give the meditator to do rising, falling, and then switch, because there may be a break, but not during the break. You just switch and focus on the fact that you're sitting, and you say to yourself, sitting. But you don't have to worry about it between the breath, but you know, there's room there, so you just say, sitting. And then wait for the next rising, rising, falling, sitting. But the sitting might take some time, and anyway, that's something we do for... And during the meditation course, we'll give more complicated exercises as the meditator's mindfulness gets stronger.
based on your post today about choosing gender, would you please talk more about your view on this? Can those that choose gender choose only for themselves, or are they special in that way that they have some key vision and can choose anyone and everyone's gender? Even so far, saying the Buddha was a hermaphrodite, for example, I really don't understand how it would work. I know homosexuality is sometimes in the story seen as gender change, but is that a choice?
Honestly, that I'm not for choosing your gender, but I can understand it because of, you know, based on lives and past lives and that kind of thing. And it seems to me that it's probably better to be true to your inner sexuality than to repress it or pretend, you know. If you, and I guess it's not even sexuality, but if you feel masculine, then but you're in a woman's body, or if you feel feminine and you're in a man's body, then it doesn't seem to be a problem to sort of straighten things out. I guess the big problem is with hormone therapy and who knows what, you know, you have to go through it. It's not, I'm not really for it, and I don't think as a Buddhist it's proper to have a gender change or that kind of gender reassignment, whatever they call it. Doesn't seem to me to be the proper way, because of course Buddhism is about letting go of our attachments. It would be much more efficient and profitable to just, you know, learn to see these thoughts as just thoughts. Who cares what body you're in? I mean, what if I was in a body of a horse? Well, big deal, you know? It's just a body. Of course, a horse can't meditate, but, you know, a masculine, male, female body, it doesn't really matter which body you're in. It's just a body, right? To be honest, it was more about, I've been approached recently by Christians, now that I'm getting out and about, seem to be crawling out of the woodwork. I met you know, these two guys walking along, and one of them turns to me and says, "Hey," and they're so friendly. And I thought, oh, well, maybe these people are interested in meditation, and we talked, and then this woman came up, and now there's three of them, a young woman, a young man, and young women. And then, you know, they asked me about religion and what religions I'm interested in, and then one of them, then I start to get suspicious, because he says, you ever think about studying biblical religions? And then one of them tells me that we're Christians, and suddenly it's all about Jesus, and then I'm like, okay, I gotta go. And then today a guy looked at me walking down the street, and walked past, and then he walked past again, and he looked at me again, and he said, "Are you a monk?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, I think he said cool or something, and as he walked away he said, "Jesus loves you." Nice. So then when I saw the Pope was mouthing off about these things that he shouldn't, I thought, it just seemed like he was on such a roll talking about poverty and you know, things that were actually going to be important. It just seems to me, why would you worry about other people's gender? You know, why would you worry about other people having gender changes? Why would this be something to be concerned with when there's such bigger things to worry about, I think? I mean, I guess I shouldn't minimalize it, because it could be potentially problematic to have a gender change. I'm not really for it, but I'm not going to judge people or condemn people for it. I just don't like people to be obsessed with such things personally. So it was kind of, I don't know about that post. But all the things you're asking, your actual questions, choosing gender means having a gender reassignment where you actually change your body in some way. I'm not really sure how it works, but you also take hormone therapy and that kind of thing. I mean, there are teachings where a Buddha has to be male, so there may be some real consequences with messing with your gender, but I would say it's probably not as dire as people might think. You know, it's just, I think there are much worse things to concern ourselves about, like the clinging to such beliefs. I mean, why do they care? Because God, it's not because they're concerned about the person's well-being, it's because God told them it's wrong, or their books tell them that God told them it's wrong. It's really a silly reason to believe anything.
Maybe those are people who think they only have one shot through life. the all genders. The follow-up question was, finally, are you a boy, girl, man, or woman, Bhante? Thank you.
I don't know how to answer that question. I'm a monk. I mean, there's no I. I mean, what is this, a trick question? Am I supposed to fall for it? I don't really understand. That's not a good question.
And the other thing you say, I don't answer questions about myself.
Oh yes, I don't answer questions about myself. Next question.
Is it better to the practice to have a planned routine, like the hour of going to sleep, like an hour of going to sleep, waking up, meditating, etc.?
Potentially, but there's also the potential for getting caught up in control, you see, you know, expectations. If you have a schedule, you know, it's good in a sense to keep. I guess it's just that you'd want to remind yourself or keep in mind that life is uncertain and things change and your schedule will have to adapt. You know, if you get so stuck on a schedule, and then when something comes up to break your schedule, you freak out. No problem. Or you say, I can't meditate because I missed the hour to meditate. That's not how it works. So I would say it's probably more of a novice thing to do, and an advanced ninja meditator will be adaptive and will be able to fit meditation in wherever it's convenient and not convenient, but wherever it's wherever there's room. It's much more, you know, it eventually becomes much more natural and much more. So I'd say yes, actually the schedules are great as long as you don't cling to them and you adapt them, but should never, you know, it's good if you come back to them when you can, because it keeps you honest, it keeps you focused. Well, there's no I to have no self. If you say I have no self, you're. It's a paradox, kind of, right? That's all the Buddha's saying. It's a good point. You know, this is why you get caught up. You get mixed up if you say there is no self. You're kind of saying the same thing because you're already assuming that a self could exist, meaning. You're assuming the existence of entities, and as soon as you assume the existence of entities that exist, the existence of entities of which the self is not one, you've already got self, because an entity is a self. So the point is that the universe is not made up of entities. That's really, I would say, the best way to understand self and not self. So if you say I, you've already got an entity.
Mm-hmm. Having come across numerous written descriptions on the five aggregates, I can understand what form, feelings, mental formations, and consciousness are. But I don't get what perception is. Is it a mental concept of things?
It's not. Perception is the wrong word. It's actually a mistranslation. The word perception means actually consciousness. I didn't realize it, but if you look it up in the dictionary, it really just means to be aware of something. But because we use it as your perception, you know, It was used for sanya, but sanya means, sang means like, nya is to know something like something else. So it's recognition. There was a bhikkhuni from Taiwan who argued with me about this, and she said something else, and I realized she's right, that sanya can actually mean many things. It's used in different ways, but in terms of the five aggregates, I'm quite clear that it means memory and recognition. When you recognize something, which we call memory, that's sanya. So if you see something and you recognize it as red or yellow, or you recognize it as a cup, or you recognize it as a person and you remember their name, that's sanya. sati and sannya are related. Actually, tira sannya is the proximate cause of sati. That's a very good point, and it was a good question. Tira sannya, when you remember something for what it is, and you remember it, right? Remind yourself about it. That's sati. So they are related, and in fact, etymologically, they're related as well. No, maybe not. No, they're not. They're not etymologically related, strike that. But sannya and sati are related, and read the commentaries, which is a great way to explain why we say to ourselves, seeing. Because that tira sannya, tira means strong and firm. Sannya is recognition. When you recognize something and you fix yourself on that recognition, that's sati. Of course, it also means not recognizing it as red or blue, but recognizing it as seeing. Because red isn't real, red is sannya. Red is it's a kind of a sannya. I don't know. Again, you can say red, but because the red is not real, it's sannya, but a concept. It's a sati, it's still sati, but it's not vipassana, it won't lead to insight. It's based on the object, that's all. But yeah, sannya and sati are cause and effect with each other. Sannya is the cause. It's when you strengthen it.
I'm finding noting wanting quite difficult, as it seems ambiguous and rarely clear. In one of your videos, you mentioned that wanting is a kind of stress. Could you elaborate or give general advice on proper noting of it? Thank you, Bhante.
Well, wanting is momentary, you know? It's fleeting. So it wouldn't, unless you realize that you're wanting something, it wouldn't say wanting, but maybe you're thinking about it too much, because do you ever want anything? Do you know that you're wanting something? For sure, there are times where you want something. If you think of a cheeseburger and you want it, or you think of a song and you want to listen to it, or you just think of a person and you want to see them, something pleasant and you want to touch it or smell it or taste it or listen to it, that's all wanting. The wanting is there. I wouldn't overthink it. If there's wanting, just say to yourself, wanting. The point is not to really focus and understand too much about the thing. The point is to not react to it, so that you just see, okay, there it was wanting and now it's gone. And over time, you'll start to see things in that way. Okay, it came and it's gone. And all we need to learn is that things come and go, basically, because then you'll see that you'll realize that they're unsatisfying and uncontrollable. And wouldn't overthink it too much. If you're aware that here I am wanting this, just say wanting. You don't have to be too. You don't have to catch it. You see, and you can't catch it. In fact, it may very well be that your confusion is because you're in one of the jnanas where you see things ceasing before you can really grasp them and get a sense of what they are, which is important. It's important to see that things are always ceasing and you can't hold on to them. They're not going to wait around for you to study them. And that's important, because the study that you need to do is that they don't stick around. I don't really understand. I mean, our practice doesn't. If you read my book on how to meditate, you'll get a sense of how we practice. I think the link is all you need to connect. It seems to work. I mean, some people have been complaining it isn't working, so that's a shame, but my understanding is that it works.
I think you do have to do something to maybe just make sure that you have Hangouts installed and set up properly. So probably just make sure that it's somewhere on your, on your PC or device, and maybe go through the settings. Because I seem to remember that install something at one point. But you don't need to add anyone. You'll just be able to just click on the link.
Okay. You finished?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Have a good night. Thanks, Robin, for joining us.
Thank you, Bhante.
See you all tomorrow.